February 4th, 2012, Radha Desh, appearance day of Lord Varaha. Okay, so turn to the Dasa Avatar. Page is that?
Adi,
of the enemy,
Durukta,
by the abusive words,
Somarai,
by the weapons,
Janstra Agra,
on the ends of his tusks,
Gam,
situated,
Gam,
the earth,
Upalaksha,
Sing,
Vitam,
frightened,
Todam,
the pain,
Nushan,
bearing,
Niragat,
he came out,
Amumadyat,
from the midst of the water,
Draha,
by a crocodile,
Ahataha,
attacked,
Sakarenu,
along with the she elephant,
Yata,
as
Iba,
an elephant.
Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada.
Although the Lord was pained by the shaft-like abusive words of the demon, he bore the pain. But seeing that the earth on the ends of his tusks was frightened, he rose out of the water, just as an elephant emerges with its female companion when assailed by an alligator. Purport. The Mayavadi philosopher cannot understand that the Lord has feelings. Do you ever think about that? The Lord is satisfied if someone offers him a nice prayer, and similarly, if someone decries his existence or calls him by ill names, God is dissatisfied. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is decried by the Mayavadi philosophers, who are almost demons. They say that God has no head, no form, no existence, and no legs, hands, or other bodily limbs. In other words, they say that he is dead or lame. All these misconceptions of the Supreme Lord are a source of dissatisfaction to him. He is never pleased with such atheistic descriptions. In this case, although the Lord felt sorrow from the piercing words of the demon, he delivered the earth for the satisfaction of the demigods who are ever his devotees. The conclusion is that God is as sentient as we are. He is satisfied by our prayers and dissatisfied by our harsh words against him. In order to give protection to his devotee, he is always ready to tolerate insulting words from the atheist. In order to give protection to his devotee, he is always ready to tolerate insulting words from the atheists. Satyu jimano ri duruk tatamwaya dams chagra gam gam upalakshabi tam todam mirshan nyuragat ambulajat raha hata sa karaner yate bhya. Although the Lord was pained by the shaft-like abusive words of the demon, he bore the pain. And seeing that the earth on the ends of his tusks was frightened, he rose out of the water just as an elephant emerges with his female companion while assailed by an alligator. So one day, a long, long, long time ago, there were two gatekeepers in Vaikuntha who one time had stopped Lakshmi from entering the Lord's house when he was sleeping. As a result of this, Lakshmi predicted that they would come to the material world. And indeed, when the four Kumaras came to the gates of Vaikuntha, to the seventh gate, having passed through six gates, the gatekeepers said, "You're just little children. We're not going to let you in." Sometimes we do that in the Hare Krishna movement, too. Yeah. "You're just little children. We're not going to let you in." So the Kumaras were rather angry. They said, "You don't belong here in Vaikuntha. You belong in the material world." And the doorkeepers were very sorry. Lord Vishnu comes out with Lakshmi in all of his splendor and said, "I knew this was going to happen. Lakshmi already predicted it. And by the curse of the Kumaras, you would take seven births, but I will reduce it to three. Because Jayan Vijay had said, whatever happens, we don't want to forget you. We don't want to lose our Krishna consciousness." And so Lord Vishnu says, "All right, you will keep your Krishna consciousness in anger." So, in the material world, Kasyapa Muni, who had 13 wives, and he had had children with all of them except for Diti. So she wanted children too, and somehow she was particularly disturbed. She couldn't wait even for a moment, and she approached her husband and she said, you know, I want to have relations with you right now. And he said, no, I need to chant my Gayatri. It's not the right time. It's the Sandhya. Please wait. Lord Shiva's going around with your sister. And he's finding ghosts. He's taking ghosts and putting them in the wombs of women who are having relations at this time. She said, I'm sorry, I can't wait. He said, okay. And then afterwards, she felt very sorry. And she said, please make sure that Lord Shiva doesn't curse me. And her husband said, you foolish woman, you should have listened to me. He said, you're going to have two demon sons who will be killed by the Lord. And she said, oh, at least they'll be killed by the Lord and not by Indra. Because if they're killed by the Lord, they'll get liberation. And he said, and because you're sorry, because you're repentant, one of your grandsons will be a great devotee of the Lord, who is, of course, Prahlada Maharaj. So Aditi didn't actually want to cause trouble for anyone. So she's, you know, she's a demigoddess, so she was able to keep her pregnancy for 100 years. But even just that the children were in her womb caused disturbance in the universe. And Lord Brahma then told this story to the devas of how Jaya and Vijaya were taking their birth. So finally they were born, there was great disturbance in the universe. Hiranyakashipu got boons from Brahma, and Hiranyaka, to please his brother, was going around picking fights everywhere. And it's explained in the second canto that he engaged other demons on the earth to drill for oil. And by drilling for oil, they upset the balance of the earth. And the earth fell out of its orbit into the universal waters. So during that time, Lord Brahma was looking and thinking, I'm supposed to be populating the universe, but they have to have a place to stay. You know, if you have children, you have to have a place to put them. You have to have a room or a house or something. You know, I had this earth planet for them to stay on, but now it's in the bottom of the ocean. What am I going to do? And he was meditating on Lord Vishnu. And as he meditated on Lord Vishnu, a little boar came out of his nose. So the Lord has many different appearances. Lord Vasingadeva comes out of a pillar. And Matsya disappears in the ocean. But Varaha comes out of Lord Brahma's nose. It came out very tiny. Of course, Brahma's kind of big, so tiny compared to Brahma, like the end of a thumb. And he pretty assumed this gigantic form and roared in the universe. And it's a wonderful description. Hearing. First of all, this boar was seen no bigger than the tip of a thumb. Within a moment, he was large as a stone. My mind is perturbed. Is he the Supreme Personality of Godhead? While Brahma was deliberating with his sons, Vishnu roared tumultuously like a great mountain. The prophet says that mountains can also roar. I've never heard one roar. The Supreme Personality of Godhead just enlivened Brahma and the other highly elevated brahmanas by again roaring with his voice. And when the sages heard the tumultuous roar, they chanted auspicious chants from the three Vedas. Playing like an elephant, he entered into the water after roaring again in reply to the Vedic prayers. Before entering the water to rescue the earth, Lord Boar flew in the sky, slashing his tail, his hard hairs quivering. His glance was luminous. The Lord's glance is called Sudarshan, and the sun is also Sudarshan. His glance is actually, for us, we have to have light enter our eyes in order to see, for the Lord's light comes out of his eyes. And he scattered the clouds in the sky with his hoofs and his glittering white tusks. Because he had the body of a hog, he searched after the earth by smell. His tusks were fearful, and he glanced over the devotee brahmanas engaged in offering prayers. Thus he entered the water. Dividing the water like a great mountain, Lord Boar diving into the water like a great mountain, Lord Boar divided the middle of the ocean, and two high waves appeared as the arms of the ocean, which cried loudly as if praying to the Lord, O Lord of all sacrifices, please do not cut me in two. Lord Boar penetrated the water with his hooves, which were like sharpened arrows, and he found out the limits of the ocean, although it was unlimited. He saw the earth, the resting place for all living beings, lying as it was in the beginning of creation, and he personally lifted it. Lord Boar very easily took the earth on his tusks and got it out of the water, thus he appeared very splendid. Okay, so that's what Lord Boar is doing. Meanwhile, Hiranyaksha wants to fight. You ever met people who want to fight? Sometimes maybe we get in that kind of mood too. You ever get in the mood that you actually want to fight? You know, somebody says something to you, or you hear about something, and you become, I want to fight. You ever feel that way? Probably. Because we're all part of Krishna. He feels that way sometimes. Sometimes he feels that one fight. So, and that was what happened with Jambavan. Krishna induced Jambavan to forget who he was, so he would fight with him. And so Hiranyaka is in this mood also, I want to fight with somebody. And he didn't even have to have a cause. No cause. So he goes to Varuna and he says, can I fight with you? And Varuna says, I'm too old. Sometimes we deal with aggressive people, and instead of actually dealing with them on their own terms, we just make some excuse, isn't it? Somebody, you know, writes you some letter or talks to you, this, why don't you do something about this? And you go, oh yeah, I'm kind of busy right now. Why don't you ask somebody else? So that's what Varuna did. He said, I'm too old. He said, you know what, if you really want to fight with someone, right now, Lord Vishnu is in the causal ocean, the universal ocean, bottom of the universe. He's lifting up the earth. He's a good combatant. He'll defeat you. And somehow the demons get enlivened by this. You know, they hear someone's going to defeat you, and they say, yes, let me go get defeated. This happened with, Banasura, the father of Usha, where he had these 1,000 arms by the grace of Lord Shiva. He went to Lord Shiva and he said, I can't find an equal combatant. It's not very satisfying. And Lord Shiva said, someday you'll find someone who will defeat you. So if you have a sportive mentality and you're very good at something, you want to find somebody who's your equal that you can defeat, and you also want to find somebody who's better than you. There's some satisfaction in being defeated by a better opponent. So, of course, Krishna likes to get defeated by the counterboys. You know the story in Pulambasura, where Krishna's side loses, Balaram's side wins. So even Krishna sometimes likes to get defeated. So Hiranyaka became very enlivened by this. And when persons are fighting, they have to first instigate the other party to fight. You know, if I just walk up to you and I say, fight with me, you know, look at me, what? So, but if I go to you and say, here it is, here it is, what about this, you do this, you do that, then your anger is riled. So the warriors on the battlefield often do this. This is Krishna's dhirodhata feature, where he will trade insults with his enemies. Okay, so this is what Hiranyaka does. He sees Lord Vishnu in this boar form, lifting up the earth on the end of his tusks. And he says, he saw there the all-powerful personality of Godhead in his boar incarnation, bearing the earth upward on the ends of his tusks and robbing him of his splendor with his reddish eyes. The demon laughed. Oh, an amphibious beast. He said, Vana gocharaha. Vana means forest. And then he said, Nuga. So it could mean a creature who lives in the forest. It can also mean a creature who lives in the water. And Sridhar Swami has said that this refers to how the Lord lies in the water as Mahavishnu, and the demon was indirectly praising him. And of course, the Lord did appear as an amphibious beast. He appeared as a boar who would spend some time in the water and some time on land. But of course, he's not an animal. But so the first thing, like if I say to you, you're just an animal. It's an insult. So Hiranyaksha goes, oh, best of the demigods dressed in the form of a boar, this earth is entrusted to us, the inhabitants of the lower regions, and you cannot take it from my presence and not be hurt by me. So the demons are always claiming the earth. The earth is a very pivotal place in the universe. I think of it as kind of like the kindergarten of the universe, because here, you know, here human children have a very long childhood. You read about how the demigods, they just grow up immediately. They don't have to go, we don't need a bhakti vinanta college in Swarga. because everybody just grows up very quickly. They learn very quickly, not like this planet where we have, you know, 15, 20, 25 years of childhood and youthfulness for training. This is the training ground. It's called Karma Bhumi. This is where one is trained in right conduct and where one can go from here to any part of the universe. And this is also one of the prime gateways for liberation from the material world. Not the only one. Sometimes devotees say you can only go back to Godhead from Earth. That's not a fact. Just hearing that this morning in the story of King Rigger, how Prabhupada said that he became a demigod and from there he could also go back to home, back to Godhead. But anyway, so the Earth is very important. And just like little children are very vulnerable in human society, there's many people who try to get control of the schools because they know that however you train the children, that will determine society. Child is the father of man. So whatever you do on the Earth planet will determine everything in the universe because that's where the demigods and the demons are coming from. They're coming from the Earth planet. Just like the communists, you know, they want to take over the schools, or the Nazis, they took over the schools. We haven't quite figured this out in the Hare Krishna movement. That somehow we've missed this concept. That if we really want to change the culture of the world, we have to aim at education of children. Anyway, someday I assume we'll figure this out. So the demigods and the demons, they've understood this. They don't have a problem with this concept. So the demigods and the demons, they're very interested in who has control over the earth. So there's frequent battles between the demons and the demigods for control of the earth. So here, and we're very vulnerable, we earthlings. You know, we're not very sophisticated in things like mystic powers and we can't really, we're like children in the universe, we can't really take care of ourselves. So if we're not protected by the devas and by God, the demons take over. And sometimes they have battles in the heavens for the earth, like this battle. Sometimes they actually come to the earth, like in the Mahabharata and in the Ramayana, the demons and the devas incarnated on the earth. Sometimes Krishna incarnates on the earth and they actually fight out the battles for possession of the earth right here. This one was done outside the earth. So this is Hiranyaka's claim. He's saying, I own the earth. It's mine. I mean, haven't you ever wondered that, why they care? Ever wondered why the demons and the demigods care so much about this lower middle planet? You'd think they'd have better things to fight over. I mean, just like we fight over these Middle Eastern countries. And my apologies to those of you who live there, who've been from there, but have you ever been there? It's just sand. You know, why are we fighting? There's not even any water there. You know that, right? There's no water. They have to desalinate the ocean water to have drinking water. The aquifers are all salty. You can't grow anything there, except in Oasis you can grow some dates. That's why the traditional culture, they ate a lot of dried fruits. Not what Indians mean by dried fruits, but tree fruits that have been dried, not nuts. Because that's all they could import. They couldn't get any fresh fruits. Of course, now they do all kinds of artificial things. But anyway, why do we fight so hard for these places? Because there's oil there, under the sands, there's wealth. So why do the demons and the demigods fight so hard for the earth? Because this is where the wealth of the universe is coming from. This is what determines the whole nature of the universe. You turn the earth demoniac, and it will affect the whole universe. You rascal, you have been nourished by our enemies to kill us, and you have killed some demons by remaining invisible. Oh fool, your power is only mystic. So today I shall enliven my kinsmen by killing you. So the demons often minimize Krishna's power. Oh, you just played some tricks, you know, you had some magic. The demon continued, when you fall dead with your skull smashed by the mace hurled by my arms, the demigods and sages who offer you oblations and sacrifice in devotional service will also automatically cease to exist like trees without roots. So he's calling the Lord a beast. He's telling him, you don't really have any power, just mystic power. I'm going to smash your head in. And then all of your devotees and sages will also die. So Lord Varaha felt pained. Jumana. He was disturbed. Prabhupada says here, the Mayavadi philosophers cannot understand that the Lord has feelings. So that was painful to him, for someone to say, if you don't have any real power, I'm going to smash your head in, and all of your devotees and the demigods will then die. But he didn't immediately respond. Why not? But what did it say in today's verse? Why didn't Lord Varaha immediately respond to the demon? Because he had the earth on his tusks. It says here, but seeing that the earth on the ends of his tusks was frightened. Now the earth, of course, is the Lord's wife. The earth is the Lord's wife. And it's explained in Chaitanya Bhagavad in Madhrikan chapter 13. The Chaitanya Mahaprabhu explains that during this Leela, the earth, that Lord Varaha was impregnating the earth with Nataka. So he understood the earth was frightened and he wanted to situate her properly on the water before he responded to Hiranyaka. And Prabhupada says here that in order to give protection to his devotee, he's always ready to tolerate insulting words from the atheist. And these words are compared to shafts. So although when we were children, we said things like, sticks and stones can break my bones, but words can never hurt me. Actually, it's really the opposite. That insulting words and cruel speech and cruel relationships are often much more painful than physical injury and can cause much more grief. I was mentioning the other day, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says there's three levels of rasa. One is physical, which he calls the earth rasa. One is emotional, which he calls heavenly rasa. And the other is spiritual. So this insulting words is a disturbance on the emotional platform, on a higher platform. Because although on one level as embodied beings we have a need for physical security and physical health and vitality and peace. I've often thought what's the opposite of pain? It's peace. But actually on a much higher level than that, we have a very deep need for loving relationships and loving and caring community. And when that's disturbed, that's much more difficult than just difficulty to the body. It's like, you know, Krishna talks about the different levels, that the bottom level is the gross senses, higher than that is the mind, higher than that is the intelligence, higher than that is the soul. So we're getting closer and closer to the spiritual platform. And we could think, sometimes devotees think, that the way to deal with this pain of insults and not just direct insults like this, but sometimes indirect insults, slights, or being, how do you say, kept left out of something, excluded from something, anywhere where we get this feeling, justified or unjustified, that rather than people appreciating us and liking us and wanting to be with us, that people want to hurt us, that people have harm in mind for us. So anytime we have that, we may feel, well, the solution, I mean, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that one should tolerate, right? One should just be tolerant. And so many verses in the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna talks about being tolerant of honor and dishonor and fame and infamy. And we may think that what that means is that I don't have any feelings. I mean, I just got a letter just a couple days ago from one devotee who told me that another devotee had been very cruel to her over a very long period of time. She said, what I did was I hardened my heart. Now, the result of her hardening her heart ended up in a fall down from the principles of Krishna consciousness. And we end up thinking many times that the way to deal with that, what Krishna means by tatikshava, what Krishna means by tolerance, is hardening the heart. We don't find here that Lord Varaha is hardening his heart. That's not what he's doing. It's not that he doesn't care. He's not becoming like a stone. But that's not, tolerance doesn't mean, well, you know, I'm not affected because I'm not a living being. How is the Lord tolerating here? First of all, he is going to act on it. It's not that he's not going to act on it. But how is he tolerating it here?
He gives preference.
He's giving preference to the devotees. He's tolerating it because his service requires it. Because if he immediately responded to the demon, then the earth would be more frightened or be in a position of vulnerability. He came there to save the earth. So he put the service to the devotees higher than dealing with his own feelings directly and immediately. So this is ultimately how we become tolerant. We become tolerant of personal insults. And life is full of personal insults. If God gets insulted, then there's no hope that we're not going to get insulted. You know, sometimes we think, oh, now I've come to the society of devotees, you know, no one's ever going to insult me anymore. Everybody should be nice to me. Of course, one thing we can think of is, am I nice to everybody? Generally, we don't think like that. We just think of how people have insulted me, and we don't think of how we may have insulted others. Because, of course, when I insult others, it's not really insults. I'm just speaking the truth, of course. They're insulting me, but I'm just being honest. And, you know, their insults are not necessary, but when I speak the honest, bitter truth, it's very necessary. It has a higher purpose. And other people should just, you know, stoically deal with whatever negative things I have to say about them, because that's all in service. But when people insult me, then they're acting like a demon. And how are they, who let them in the Hare Krishna movement anyway? In Vrindavan, I forget what verse it was in the Bhagavad Gita, but we were talking about how Krishna will tolerate fall downs and offenses from his devotees for quite some time. And I made some statement about how it took me 10 years to realize that I had offended somebody. You know, I had offended some devotees, and it wasn't until 10, I thought they'd offended me. And it was 10 years later that I realized I had offended them. And one of the devotees in the class said, why did Krishna tolerate that you were offensive for 10 years? I said, but you wanted to kick me out. So we think like that, you know, we think Krishna should tolerate, the devotee should tolerate my misbehavior, but I'm not going to tolerate anybody else's. In any case, when these things happen, instead of just immediately retaliating in any way, shape, or form, or hardening our heart, we think of what's best for my service. What's going to please Krishna? What's going to please the devotees? I mean, and ultimately, Lord Varaha responds to Hiranyaka, not just to defend himself, but because Hiranyaka was a disturbance in the universe. I mean, just to defend, why does Krishna have to defend himself? It's not necessary. It's not that Krishna's coming down, like Prabhupada's talking about these Maya bodies who say that God is dead. We don't see, you know, Lord Varaha personally coming to earth to kill all of them. Basically, you know, it's painful, but he goes on with his business. But in this case, because Hiranyaksha was such a direct threat, he had to be dealt with. And of course, it was also sport. But we think like that. Somebody insults me, and first thing I should think of is, do I ever insult anybody? Maybe this is a reaction. Tatenu kamkam susamakshana. Maybe Krishna is giving me a taste of my own medicine. As one very famous psychic, Edgar Casey, said, karma is like a mirror in which you see yourself. So is Krishna just trying to show me this is what you're behaving like? And maybe we behave like that in a little different form, in a little different way, with a different person. So we don't recognize that we're doing it, because I may not insult somebody exactly in that way. I may do it in a little different way, or maybe I did it with a little different people. So that's the first thing to ask. Is this Krishna telling me that I should be, that, you know, see, this is what it feels like. Don't do this to others. Don't treat others like this. Is he telling me that I have my center in the wrong place? Many times when we're really affected by insults and difficult dealings with others, it's because we're thinking that that person is supposed to be Krishna for us. We're thinking that that person's pleasure or displeasure with me is going to give me or not give me what I need to be happy. You know, this is very common, of course, in very close relationships. But just like if you work at a job, if your boss is unhappy with you, you might be fired. And then you won't have any money. And then you won't have any place to live. And you'll be living out on the street. And you'll be eating out of the trash cans. So therefore, if your boss is insulting you, you become very frightened. And out of that fear comes anger and some kind of retaliation. I've got to fix it. So many times we get very affected when people insult us because we feel that that person is the source of something that I need. We forget that Krishna is the source of what I need. That Krishna is maintaining me, not my boss. Whether I live out on the street and eat out of trash cans is up to Krishna, not up to the head of the company that I work for. And that's true with everything. You know, I see that a lot of anger that devotees have toward the institution of ISKCON is thinking that the institution is God. It's thinking that the altar is the deity instead of that the deity is the deity. And if you think that the institution is God, then you become very, very angry when somebody who has some position in the institution doesn't deal with you in a way that you like, because you think, wow, if this person doesn't deal with me nicely, my whole spiritual life is finished. And I just had somebody ask me that question. They said, I've heard that you can't make one iota of advancement unless all of the authorities in the temple are happy with you. Wow. And if we preach like that, we're going to create enemies of ISKCON. Because, frankly, we're never going to deal with everybody perfectly all the time. It's just not going to happen. We're not God. We can't be God. We're never going to be God. It's just not going to happen. And if we present ourselves as God, then people are going to become very angry. You know, we've created a whole group of people who have as their life's mission to try to find any fault with our Hare Krishna movement. And most of them are members or former members. And part of the reason, not, it's not the only reason, part of the reason was trying to tell them, you know, the institution is God. It's not. Or the town president or the GBC or even your guru is God. Sakshat Hari Trina. Prabhupada, when devotees started saying that he was God, he threw them out of the movement. He said, if you say guru is God, then you're thinking, oh, someday I'll become guru and I'll become God. Yeah. He threw them out. I mean, they were really thrown out. They were put on a bus. And the bus ticket was paid, and they were just dropped off on the side of the road. Of course, what was really sweet about that is when they were dropped off on the side of the road in a far distant place, and they had no place to stay, and they were just wandering on the side of the road, and they lay down in the woods to sleep. In the morning, a little boy brought them bread and milk and said, my mother saw you guys sleeping here and brought you, wanted, told me to bring you something to eat. So even if you get thrown out, Krishna will still take care of you. But anyway, that's another reason why we may react strongly to insults. Because we're thinking, I have to get this person to like me. I have to get this person to accept me. Otherwise, I won't have any shelter. The pleasure of this person is essential for me. This is one of the big reasons why there's fights in household life, by the way. That the man's thinking, my wife has to like me all the time. She's not going to. You know, or the wife's thinking, my husband has to be pleased with me all the time. It's not going to happen. Sometimes people are pleased with you, sometimes they're not. It's just what it is. So these are the things we can think of when we feel this pain. It's not that we don't feel the pain. Of course we're going to feel the pain. We're a sentient being. God feels the pain. That's okay. It just means we're alive. You don't have to think, oh, I feel some pain that someone insulted me, therefore I'm just a nonsense. No, it means you're a soul. You know, the microphone doesn't feel any pain. You
grasp the microphone.
He doesn't care, because it has no feelings. And then you think, first of all, do I insult others? Is this something that I should see as a way of looking deeper into my own heart as to how I treat others? My dear Krishna, please show me if I ever treated somebody like this that I haven't rectified, and help me to fix it, because I don't like this pain, therefore I don't want anyone else to go through this pain. Then you can also think, maybe this is Krishna telling me I have the wrong center. That instead of understanding that I have to please Krishna, I'm thinking I have to please this person or this group or that group separately from Krishna. Of course, if I want to please Krishna, naturally I want to make everybody else happy. But it's different. Like we were speaking the other day, that Bhaktisiddhanta is about for hostile life, where Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati said, you put everything into Krishna's account. You transfer what you're doing to Krishna's account. Instead of, I'm doing this to please my child, I'm doing this to please my husband, I'm doing this to please Krishna. I'm serving the devotees to please Krishna. The devotees may be happy with me, they may not be happy with me, but I'm doing it to please Krishna. Just a nice example of this is Gadadhar Pandit. That Gadadhar Pandit listening to Balabhacharya. And I don't have time to tell the whole story, but the devotees were just pleased with him. But Mahaprabhu was pleased with him. And in his heart he kept praying. He said, I know the devotees are going to criticize me for this, but I know Mahaprabhu knows my heart. And then finally, the last thing, the thing here that Lord Virat is showing, is what response can I give to this insult that would be most pleasing to Krishna and the devotees? How can I respond? Because we're going to respond in some way. Even being silent is a response. How am I going to respond in a way that will be part of my service to Guru, to Krishna, to the devotees, that will please the devotees? And this is the example that Lord Brahma has shown. We'll just go on a little bit. You're going into the battle? Actually, I love this story, one of my favorite stories. And one of the reasons it's one of my favorite stories is I was reading through the Bhagavatams as they were being translated. We had a hot off the press account, so as soon as Prabhupada translated the book, we got it in the mail. And I was following the instructions to read every verse in order, systematically. Because Prabhupada says if you do that, at the end of the ninth cantos, you become a self-realized soul. You know, recently in Vrindavan, at the VIHE, Burijan and Narayani finished the 12th canto. They graduated the first Bhaktivedanta students. You know, we have Bhakti Shastri, Bhakti Vaibhava, Bhakti Sarvabhama, Bhakti Vedanta. So they actually went from the first canto through the 12th. So as Hari Prasadam with Burijan, I said, so Prabhupada says that if you do that, go systematically through the Bhagavatam, you become a self-realized soul. I said, did it happen to you? He said, yeah. He said, I realize I'm a fool. Devotees are wonderful. Anyway, so as I was reading through the Bhagavatam, I got to the second canto. It has a lot of chapters that are really deep philosophy. You know, calculation of time by the atom. I mean, all these chapters that, frankly, I couldn't really get into very much. I was reading them just because I was supposed to read them. You know, the universal form, and then I got to the story. I mean, I'm just a typical example of what it talks about, how in Kali Yuga people can't, especially women, you know, we can't get so much into philosophy, we like stories. And so there's all these stories in the Shastra. I can never read the Vedanta Sutra, I'm sure. So I got to Lord Varaha's story, and I was like, yes, the story! You know, and I didn't eat or sleep or anything until I finished the story. It was so exciting. And it was the first time I was reading it, you know. I'd heard the story, of course, on the Golden Avatar cassette tapes. But now I finally had the whole Bhagavatam, so I have a particular affinity for this story. The demon who had golden hair on his head and fearful tusks gave chase to the Lord while he was rising from the water, roaring like thunder. I'm not reading every word, by the way, or we wouldn't have time. He said, are you not ashamed of running away before a challenging adversary? There is nothing reproachable for shameless creatures. So the demons see faults in good qualities. You know, Varaha was not responding because he was taking care of his wife. He was taking care of the earth. And the demon saw him as a coward. He said, "Why are you just running away?" The Lord placed the earth within his sight on the surface of the water and transferred to her his own energy and the ability to float. Brahma extolled the Lord, and the other demigods rained flowered. The demons who had a wealth of ornaments chased the Lord from behind with a great mace. The Lord tolerated his piercing ill words, but in order to reply to him, he expressed his terrible anger. The personality of God had said, now he's very clever. If you really want to defeat your opponent, you have to take their own arguments and use them against them. That's the highest level, but just by the way. First of all, you have to look at your opponent's strongest arguments. Don't just attack your opponent's weakest arguments. If you attack their, we should give a whole class in debate. It used to be, not that long ago, that all schools taught children debate. And there's one tape, I can't find the database, but I've heard it. Where Prabhupada said that Mahaprabhu was able to defeat Keshava Kashmiri because from the age of 5 in school he was trained in debate. So just a little plug for debate class, sharpens the brain. But one of the things that you do is you try to take the arguments of your opponent and turn them back on him. So you remember Hiranyaksha said, "You're just a beast." Right? Mriga, which means animal. He said, "Vana gochara mriga." So the Lord then says, again, he says, "Bo vana gochara mriga." "Yes, I am a vana gochara mriga." "You're right." He says, "Indeed, we are creatures of the jungle, and we are searching after hunting dogs like you." That's so great. "One who is free from the entanglement of death has no fear from the loose talk in which you are indulging, for you are bound up by the laws of death." So he was saying, this is not worrying me. This was the second point I was making, that our reaction to insults comes from fear, that I'm afraid that the person who's insulting me, if they don't like me, if they don't facilitate me, I'm going to lose my security in some way. So one who's free from the fear of death, the Lord says, he's not affected. He knows, you can't hurt me. Ajana chasasvatoya parano namyateha nimanashiva. I'm eternal. I can't be killed by any weapon. I can't actually be harmed by anything. My security comes in my relationship with Krishna. You're not the provider of my security. So the Lord says, plus the person has no fear. "Certainly we have stolen the charge of the inhabitants of Rasatala and have lost all shame." So he's agreeing with him. How to disarm your enemy? Agree with them. Say, "Yeah, you're right." And then they don't have anything more to say. He said, "Yeah, I've stolen your planet. And I don't have any shame. I'm running away. Although bitten by your powerful mace, I shall stay here in the water for some time, because having created enmity with a powerful enemy, I now have no place to go. You are supposed to be the commander of many foot soldiers, and now you may take prompt steps to overthrow us." He's saying, "Come on, give me everything you got. Give up all your foolish talk and wipe out the cares of your kith and kin by slaying us." So he says, "Okay, fine. You think you're so powerful? Go ahead, kill me." Very interesting how he responds. I mean, he indirectly denigrates the demon by saying, "You're bound by the laws of death. You know, that's why you're concerned." But then he says, "Yeah, I'm an amphibious beast, and I'm looking for other beasts like you to kill. And yeah, I had no shame to run away from you. Right? Yeah, I took the earth planet from you. Okay. You're a big commander, kill me." "One may be proud, yet he does not deserve a seat in the assembly if he fails to fulfill his promised word." So then Hiranyaksha trembled like a challenged cobra, and he was hissing. He quickly sprang upon the Lord, dealt him a blow with his mace. The Lord just moved slightly aside and dodged a violent mace blow aimed at his breast by the enemy, just as an accomplished yogi would elude death. The personality of Godhead now exhibited his anger and rushed to meet the demon who bit his lip. In rage, took up his mace again, began to repeatedly brandish it about. Then with his mace, the Lord struck the enemy on the right of his brow. But since the demon was expert in fighting, O gentle Vidura, he protected himself by a maneuver his own ways. In this way, the demon and the Lord struck each other with their huge maces, each enraged and seeking his own victory. Both had sustained injuries on their bodies, and each grew more and more enraged at the smell of blood on his person. It's always interesting because the Lord has no veins. In their eagerness to win, they performed maneuvers of various kinds, and their contest looked like the encounter between two forceful bulls for the sake of a cow. Then Brahma and the demigods come and watch. And Brahma starts being the cheerleading squad for Lord Varaha. And he tells him, you know, you got to kill this guy. He said, there's no need to play with this demon. Please kill him. You can kill him by your internal potency. The evening is approaching. Now, what kind of evening is it? This is happening in outer space. So I'm not exactly sure what kind of evening this is. They weren't on the Earth planet. Kindly kill him and win victory for the demigods. The auspicious period known as Abhijit, which is most opportune for victory, commenced at midday and is all but past. Therefore, dispose of this formidable foe. So he said, you can do it by your internal potency, and you can do it now. This is the right time. So this is also a lovely verse. After hearing the words of Brahma, which were free from all sinful purposes and as sweet as nectar, the Lord heartily laughed and accepted his prayer with a glance laden with love. And you see how the Lord is a person, how he's responding to the demon, how he's responding to Brahma. And of course, in one sense, he's like Brahma's child, whom the Lord, who had appeared from the nostril of Brahma, sprang and aimed his mace at the chin of the enemy, who was stalking fearlessly before him. Struck by the demon's mace, however, the Lord's mace slipped from his hand and looked splendid as it fell down whirling. This was miraculous, for the mace was blazing wonderfully. So this mace is a person, of course. Komodakai. And it cannot be defeated, but yet even in its splendor, it was circling down. So sometimes even the devotees experience apparent temporary failure. Even if you're the Lord's club, you may, as part of the Leela of the Lord, even in your blazing glory, roll down. Even though the demon had an excellent opportunity to strike his unarmed foe without obstruction, he respected the law of single combat, thereby kindling the fury of the Supreme Lord. So he's like, okay, you know, I'll wait till you have a weapon. As the Lord's mace fell to the ground and a cry of alarm rose from the witnessing crowds of gods and rishis, the personality of God had acknowledged the demon's love of righteousness and therefore invoked his Sudarshan justice. So Krishna's angry because, you know, he's a demon, but yet he's like unrighteous, honor among thieves. You know, he's saying, no, I'm dharmic. I'm dharmic. Okay, you want to play that you're dharmic? I'll get my Sudarshan. You notice also how the onlookers become very upset. So this is part of Leela. And this movement is also, Prabhupada said, Mahaprabhu's pastime. Sometimes the demons appear to be winning, and all of us get upset. Oh, no, they're going to ban Bhagavad Gita, and they're going to arrest the devotees, they're going to take away our property. As the discus began to revolve in the Lord's hands, and the Lord contended at close quarters with the chief of his Vaikuntha attendants, who had been born as Hiranyaksha, Bal's son of Diti, there issued from every direction strange expressions uttered by those who were witnessing. They had no knowledge of the Lord's reality, and they cried, may victory attend you! Pray dispatch him! Play no more with him! When the demon saw the personality of God, it was eyes just like lotus flowers. Armed with his Sudarshan discus, his senses were overpowered by indignation. He began to hiss like a serpent, and he bit his lip in great resentment. We might think, if I could just see Krishna, I would surrender. But the demons see Krishna, and they just get angry. The demons who had fearful tusks stared at the personality of God, and as though to burn him. Springing into the air, he aimed his mace at the Lord, saying, you are slain! While his enemy looked on, the Lord in his boar form, the enjoyer of all sacrificial offerings, playfully knocked down the mace with his left foot, even as it came upon him with the force of a tempest. The Lord then said, take up your weapon and try again, eager as you are to conquer me. The demon aimed his mace at the Lord and once again loudly roared. When the Lord saw the mace flying towards him, he stood firmly where he was and caught it with the same ease as Garuda, the king of birds, would seize a serpent. His valor thus frustrated, the great demon felt humiliated. Now, he didn't say, oh, I guess I should surrender. You know, well, we have this also, you know, we're like, I'm going to conquer the material energy. I'm going to be the master. I'm going to. Krishna's like, no. You want to try again? No. You want to try again? But we don't say, I guess I can't be the Lord. Can I surrender? We keep trying to be the master. The demon felt humiliated. He was reluctant to take back the maze when it was offered by the person held him by. Try again. He now took a trident, which was as rapacious as a flaming fire, and hurled it against the Lord, even as one would use penance for a malevolent purpose against a holy Brahmana. Hurled by the mighty demon with all his strength, the flying trident shone brightly in the sky. The personality of Godhead, however, tore it to pieces with the Sudarshan, just like Indra cut off a wing of Garuda. That's my story. The demon was enraged when his trident was cut to pieces. He therefore advanced toward the Lord and, roaring aloud, struck his hard fist against the Lord's broad chest, which bore the mark of Sri Vatsa, and then he became invisible. The Lord, who appeared like as a firstborn, did not feel the least quaking in any part of his body any more than an elephant when struck with a wreath of flowers. So now what did the demon do? He does what they do. You know, when the demons can't win by fair means, they take to unfair means. So we're often asked, how do we know when there's an obstacle? Does that mean I should change course or I should just become more determined? So one of the ways is there an ethical, spiritual way to combat the obstacle? Is there any way, and is that way ethical and spiritual? So here the demon runs into an obstacle. He can't do anything. Everything fails. And instead of surrendering, he takes to unethical means, takes to magic. He employed many conjuring tricks, which made people think it was the end of the universe. Fierce winds from all directions, spreading darkness, dust hailstorms, stones in volleys from every corner, as if thrown by machine guns. So, of course, I don't think they actually had machine guns, but Prabhupada's translating this word, Shaypanai, as machine guns. I guess that's all we could relate to. The luminaries in outer space disappeared because the sky was overcome with clouds. There was thunder and lightning. From the sky came pus, hair, blood, stool, urine, and bones. By the way, even in modern times, sometimes strange things fall from the sky. Mountains discharged weapons of different kinds, and naked demonesses armed with tridents came with loose hair. Cruel and savage slogans were uttered by hosts of ruffian yakshas and rakshasas who marched on foot or rode on horses, elephants, or chariots. The Lord then discharged his beloved Sudarshan, which dispersed all the magic of the demon. At that moment, Diti's breasts gave out blood. When the demon saw his magic forces dispelled, he once again became visible, and full of rage, he tried to hug Varaha, but he tried to crush hug, you know, breaking your bones, crush hug. Actually, that happened with Dhritarashtra. Dhritarashtra, when he was going after the battle of Kurukshetra, he was going to embrace Bhima. But his intention was to kill him. And so they substituted the iron statue of Bhima that Duryodhana had used for practice. So Dhritarashtra could vent his anger there. So that was that. Hiranyaksha wanted to crush the Lord within his arms. So he tried to embrace it within his arms to crush him, but to his amazement, he found the Lord standing outside the circle of his arms. So he went, and the Lord's over there. The demon began to strike the Lord with his hard fist. But then Lord Hoxha just slapped him in the root of the ear. Though struck indifferently by the Lord, the demon's body began to reel. His eyeballs bulged out of their sockets. His arms and legs broke, and the hair on his body scattered. He fell down dead like a gigantic tree, uprooted by the wind. Vermont and others arrived on the spot to see the fearfully tusked demon lying on the ground, biting his lip. The glow of his face was yet unfaded, so he didn't become the pallor of death because he was touching the soul of all souls. Although his own soul had left, the soul of all souls was still touching him. And Vermont said, "Who could meet such a blessed death?" This most sacred narrative confers extraordinary merit, wealth, fame, longevity, and all the objects of one's desire. On the field of battle, it promotes the strength of one's vital organs and organs of action. One who listens to it at the last moment of his life is transferred to the supreme abode of the Lord. Anyone who hears, chants, or takes pleasure in the wonderful narration of the killing of the Hiranyaksha demon by the Lord is at once relieved of the results of sinful activities, even the killing of a brahmana. Thank you very much. All glories to Shri Prabhupada.